I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, we discuss the psychology of being alone and the difference between being alone and loneliness. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abbruzzese are here. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right. So loneliness and being alone, of course, are not the same thing. But it's interesting to note that both are on the rise.
Yes, it is. But we do have to keep them separate, at least in terms of as we talk about them here this morning and as we experience them. Being alone is just a state. It's being without people momentarily or for a long time. Whereas loneliness is really a mental state inside the head. It has to do with longing for intimacy, the wanting of intimacy, the desire for and the sense of not having it. It goes along with feeling rejected on the outside and isolated at the point to the point of being harmed or danger. And in looking this up, I was struck by how we're wired for this because it made sense from natural selection. If you think of the development of the human race, there had to be a lot of cooperation for survival because that's the way we are. We have to cooperate. We have children that take a long time before their brains develop. So there had to be a lot of cooperation for a number of reasons. So that if an individual was extruded from the group for some behavior, and they were on the outside or the edge of the group, they would be good prey, a good target for prey, so that that would be stressful. Mm. So just the experience of being rejected outside has roots going back many, many years in our development that makes it painful to be isolated and on the outside of a group. And actually now with the advent of some of the imaging techniques that we have in science and neuroscience these days, the same part of the brain that interprets physical pain is the same part that lights up when there's social pain or rejection. So it's we're doing the same thing as feeling physical pain or experiencing the same thing as feeling physical pain when we're lonely. Not necessarily when we're alone, because you can't be satisfied with being alone.
Yeah, some people like to be alone.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's positive to be alone because solitude can really foster a good deal of insight into oneself. And some people would even say that's what real connection comes from, is a sense of knowing yourself and then going out and reaching out to others. And that only comes from solitude.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are, as Mark mentions, he really has a good encapsulation in his introduction. We are social animals. We're wired to be social. And I think possibly some of the difference in the modern age is as some people tend to self-isolate. When Mark talks about the practice in older societies of excluding someone, there has always been, and people who raise children know this, there's always been an intense negative reaction when someone is excluded from the group. You send the child to their room, you put them in a timeout chair, the child gets upset and may not even have any coherent reason why they get upset. And in many older societies, their religious totems and their religious practices included and sometimes relied upon shunning, shunning someone. And that was a great taboo. If you did something that resulted in you being shunned from your sect, then you pretty much had no place to go. You were essentially invisible. Yet still today we have some people who seem to choose the social isolation that they put themselves in. No one shuns them, but they tend to shun themselves. In some respects, we have a little bit of that in the echo of bullying or in the echo of teasing or sarcasm or I guess people call it being snarky. You know, some of the reality shows, it's cool to be snarky to someone. It's cool to be abrupt with someone. And that never is very cool. But that really harkens into our innate sensibilities of wanting to belong. And there are a lot of different reasons, which I guess we're going to go into later in the show, a lot of different reasons why people sometimes feel subjectively that they're excluded from the group when they actually have excluded themselves from the group, and there are some things they could do to overcome that.
Sure, which is probably a defensive maneuver on their part because it's risky to be in a group. It's messy. Human relationships, face-to-face relationships, are messy. They're
and
unpredictable.
Their work.
And their work.
I think some people think that they're doing others a favor. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. What did Groucho Marx say? Any group that would want me as a member, I don't want to join.
Right.
And so I think some people think they're doing the greater good by, well, I'll just keep to myself. I just won't bother because people aren't going to like me and I have nothing to offer. And they get into a mode which, if they're not careful, can really become a self-pitying kind of mode, which really affects their ability to have a decent other perception of reality. They're going to be just projecting their own thoughts onto someone else, and it's not true. People always benefit from being around someone else. There are studies done of quadriplegics who are benefits of being around other people and the fact that just in the social contact. So they're a very early study with quadriplegics back in the 1950s, I believe, they placed newborn babies in the same bed with people who are quadriplegic. And both, as you can imagine, both parties, the babies and the quadriplegic, displayed an increase in happiness and satisfaction. Mm-hmm. So there's always something that you can offer to other people. And the fact that you think that you should isolate because there's something terribly wrong with you is not the correct assumption to have. Yeah.
So how is it connected to self-esteem?
Well, yeah, self-esteem is, well, I guess self-esteem, I would probably say some people think there's such a thing as too much self-esteem, and there really is not such a thing as too much self-esteem. That would be narcissism or self-aggrandizement. Self-esteem is just the appropriate level of feeling that you are good as you are, and it's easy to feel that you're not good as you are if you have other people who are, as Mark referred to earlier, in a self-protective mechanism that they choose to ostracize others to make themselves feel better or because they're insecure. So it's really important to have a self-regulatory mechanism that we nurture inside ourselves, of which solitude is often a part, to give ourselves the opportunity to know who we are. And once we know who we are, then we can go more confidently into social interactions with other people. Now, that doesn't mean everyone is always going to like you, but it means that you're going to have the proper level of self-esteem and self-confidence to know that what the other people may be saying about you or to you is simply not based in reality. It has to be coming from them. So then cognitive behavioral psychologists go into what we call a good match. So if you're having extreme difficulty in your workplace, in your social situation, if you feel that you're being victimized, quite often it may be something as simple as not being a good match. Mm-hmm. So finding something that you are good at, finding someone, a group that you would want to be a part of, making it a good match goes a long way to self-regulation and self-reinforcement, other reinforcement of your self-concept. So you want to be in the right place. There are two schools of thought on that. One is bloom where you are, which sometimes is impossibly difficult for some people. And another is, you know, go where people want you and go where you can feel more fulfilled. Depending on the psychological makeup of the individual, one or the other could be true. And you have to understand that even if an environment worked well for you for a long period of time, it may come to a point where it's time for you to go into a different environment so you can thrive.
Sure. Yeah, self-esteem is just your inner judgment of yourself, how you objectively or subjectively look at yourself and kind of grade yourself in given situations and interactions. And unfortunately, many people tend toward the negative. We are biased toward the negative anyway. But that's where the destructive adjustments come from because of the bias toward negatively judging ourselves. And we all have an inner dialogue from going on throughout the day about how we're doing and what we're doing. Is this okay or not? And if somebody is biased toward the negative, they have a tough day.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just want to capitalize on that a bit. When we're talking about children, sometimes kids get in with, quote, the wrong crowd, unquote. And what's the point about that? Why would that such a silly thing happen? Well, people always tend to try and find a group into which they feel they can belong. Yeah. And there's also the concept of the lowest common denominator, where people will tend to gravitate to a group that they feel meets their needs and that they are equivalent to. So that's why you may find students, individual kids, that you otherwise may think have a very good self-concept, a very high self-esteem, and then went in with a crowd that could easily be called in the old days juvenile delinquents or bad kids. And why do they do that? Well, because they're trying to match their internal sense of their own self-concept, which is probably not the concept or the regard that their friends and family and teachers and others hold them in. So people always try to find an affiliation. In the old movies about mobsters, the testimony before Congress in the 1970s, I guess, about the initiation rites, these things go back generations, even to primitive societies, and make it very difficult to join an organization. So once you joined, you realize that you have joined and you can't get out. People always want to have some kind of affiliation, whether it's positive or negative, and they tend to match their affiliations with their own self-concept, which could be very different from what you think it is.
Sure. Yeah. The group provides safety and security.
And identity.
Kind of goes back. And identity. Yep. It kind of goes back to evolution and the early societies where the environment was so dangerous.
Well, and this is like speaking to like the gangs that we have now in some, I guess, all over the place. But a lot of these kids, you know, have troubled home lives. They're looking to belong. And that's a lot of why they join some of these gangs.
That's
is because they feel that, you know, family.
And also that's the same why a lot of people will seek out the military. Become part of the family of the military or the Marines, a strong culture about having family, and why people go into other militaristic kinds of organizations, brotherhoods or sisterhoods that they're in, for the same reason that people can go into a militia out in Minnesota or someplace, you know, with the same kind of goals. So the goals are always the same, but sometimes how those goals are manifested into a meaningfulness, a positive or negative meaningfulness, can vary greatly. But the underlying underpinnings of why a human would do that are always the same.
Mm-hmm. So we have this growing body of research on loneliness, and it can have negative impacts on both physical and mental health. I guess I hadn't really thought about it before. You know, we always talk about stress and the impact stress has on you, but loneliness is just as bad.
It is a stress. It is a significant stress and a meaningful one because it touches on survival issues. So it's just like, you know, the lion in the room, essentially, in terms of how the body is going to react because survival is at stake. Something very basic is at stake when the individual is experiencing that emotion of loneliness, of longing for intimacy. Intimacy means safety, security, calmness, peace. And the opposite is threat, danger. So yes, our bodies go into a fight or flight mode when we're stressed. Loneliness is one of them. And if it keeps on going, in other words, the loneliness doesn't remit, the body takes its toll because it's like it's in a combat situation day after day, so that things like aging is enhanced, weight is increased, lethargy is enhanced, concentration is poor. And then we have all the statistical associations with all kinds of diseases, including Alzheimer's, cancer. People who are lonely die faster from cancer than people who are not. And there's an association with getting cancer when you're lonely.
Right. People who are more prone to any kind of so-called psychological issues, and I include stress as a psychological issue, not just something as scary sounding as schizophrenia or major depressive disorder or anything like that. But anytime we simply are exposed to stress that increases the triggering of hormones that create inflammation.
Right.
And it's really inflammation that we suspect is the culprit in all the conditions that Mark talked about. And so many things can trigger inflammation, but it's, I think, very helpful to just eschew all the other diagnostic categories and just consider stress. Am I under stress right now? Is this a stressful situation?
Right.
How long has it been going on? And don't devote a lot of time to thinking that. As soon as you come to the, I think maybe I'm being stressed, you must immediately, and I stress the word must, immediately go to a problem solving. Well, so what can I do about this? I don't really care how you got there. Get out of there.
Yeah.
Get moving. Get yourself moving. If nothing else, literally keep moving. Get up, walk around your room, walk up and down the stairs. Just get your body moving because that combats inflammation, that combats the stress hormones, and that will change your own psychological outlook.
It's doing what your body wants to do in a fight or flight situation. It's move.
Move, yeah. Right. We're talking about the psychology of loneliness. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of loneliness with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abbruzzese. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation or if you have a question. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Last night, my husband and I went out to dinner. We're like, where is everybody? Hmm. And the bartender said, well, people just don't like to go out in this weather. You know, we've got the snow, and now we've got the ice this morning. Right. So how does a winter like this impact people and, you know, the kind of being stuck at home? And
both in both cases, I mean, a lot of people on Cape Cod, I find, don't like to go out at night anyway. After a certain time, they sort of have this mechanism that says, okay, I'm in, and I'm not leaving again. But in the wintertime, when it's something like this, they sometimes don't want to go out during the day because it's such a burden to go out during the day. And at the same time, at this point in this particular kind of winter, people are getting cabin fever. Certainly by March, people are just ready to run out and go on the beach. So there's a cabin fever issue at play. And also at the same point, you don't really want to go out, but you know you really should go out. You feel you have to do something. You've got to get off, either off Cape Cod, or you got to get out of your house. You've got to do something different. So you have a lot of ambivalence and a lot of difficulty in deciding how you can sort of get yourself out and get moving again, because this isolation does take a toll on people, and we're not used to this kind of winter. It doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. All right. So how do we define or diagnose loneliness? It's because it sounds like it's different in everybody.
Yeah, it's an individual experience, and it is going to be different to everybody. But we've talked many times on this show about the importance of mindfulness, and I think that's how you diagnose it. You look at yourself objectively, you know, or as objectively as you can, and sense what your body is telling you. If there's a sense of longing or heaviness, and you're not interacting, then a good chance that loneliness has raised its head.
Right. The question is, what do you do about it then? So, for example, if you're an elderly person living alone and your family members have moved away, your neighbors have moved away or gone into assisted living facilities or passed on, then you could feel even more isolated and alone, as well as being lonely, than they bargained for. And it's not because of anything you did. But just the environment has changed, and the environment can exert a huge influence upon our self-perception. And our negative self-perceptions really are like water creeping up the basement. They sort of sneak up on us. So when Mark says, pay attention, be mindful of what's going on, many people in certainly American society are so unused to that concept, they probably won't have an idea on how to do it. And I'm reminded of the stories of people who are in the military, who always eschewed the idea of post-traumatic stress disorder in their troops that they commanded until they experienced it on their own and was identified to them. They had no idea. And then they were filled with guilt and remorse for having doubted the people who did have PTSD. And so certainly sometimes people need some kind of epiphany. They need some kind of education or some kind of wake-up call that what they're experiencing is stress and it is due to loneliness. They may attribute it to something else, attribute chest pain to a heart attack when it's not a heart attacker. So people really need to get some education and start to explore how they can get in touch with themselves, because the internal journey is really the most fruitful. It makes you much more successful at outside interactions with people. It makes you a better employer, a better individual, you know, a better friend.
Since you mentioned the Army, it reminded me of something I came across in looking at this. The Army has actually done some research and invested money in research on loneliness because, as it turns out, makes sense. Soldiers that get along well with one another or connected with one another make better soldiers, better fighters. And it turns out when they survey soldiers who are feeling lonely and look at them later on, they're more likely to develop PTSD than others. So the Army has come up with, or the psychologists in the Army have introduced a social cognition training program where the leaders are asked to try to identify who in their unit seems to be lonely and pay some specific attention to them. And then they've actually tried to train these people in social cognition techniques, like having them look at different expressions on faces and identify them to basically enhance their social awareness. And there has been evidence that it helps. So this is an area of treatment and intervention that is being developed and is being developed in a very practical way by the armed services.
Let's talk about social media, because it often has the opposite effect than some might think. Instead of connecting us to all these so-called friends, it can make people feel lonely. You know, we've got Facebook.
Yeah, there's some studies out now that indicate that people who are on Facebook actually, they become more depressed and they feel more socially isolated. And it's important to understand that technology is about the thing, not about the person. Mm-hmm. You know, Facebook doesn't care whether I look at it or a monkey or my dog is looking at it. Facebook just exists. The technology exists. But how it affects the individual is very important. So when people talk about does social media enhance or stop someone from being happy or being sad, it really depends on the individual, what's going on with them. Do they have any underlying conditions? Are they stressed? Are they lonely to begin with? It could enhance whatever underlying condition that people are having. People who have a pretty good self-esteem will run across something maybe on their Facebook page that is insulting or stupid, and they're going to laugh it off because they know it's the work of someone who's being, you know, disingenuous. But if you feel bad about yourself to begin with, you're going to believe what they say.
Mm-hmm.
Your filter is gone, and you're going to think, oh, no, I guess this is true. It must be like that. So what Mark talks about, mindfulness and the studies that the Army are doing and the intervention, it sounds like a very wimpy kind of intervention. You just take a look at some pictures. You're able to get the right vocabulary word. Well, how lame is that? Well, you can look at it that way, but I would suggest that you are already in the middle of being negative and lonely because the treatment for this is remarkably simple. You don't have to change the kind of diet you're having. You don't have to go out and do 40 push-ups. You don't have to, you know, put yourself on a strict pill regimen. It's very, very simple. It starts with awareness, and then it starts with changing your thoughts. And if you want to feel more connected, you could be connected to nature. You have a lot of people who are well past the childbearing age, you know, mothers, great-grandmothers, and they have gardens. You know, grandpas have gardens. They have hobbies. Well, the older generation knew this, and they were always down in their workshop in the basement fiddling around. God knows what they're doing down there. Well, they were feeling good down there. Mm-hmm. They were feeding themselves. They were nurturing themselves. And I think this generation and the generation we're in, the one that came after us, they don't have that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So they're looking for some way to sort of fill their cup.
That's interesting.
It starts with just a very simple self-awareness exercise. And once you prime that pump, the water starts to flow.
Yeah. The mechanism, I think, of becoming more lonely or depressed when looking at Facebook would be when you see people with hundreds of friends and you automatically assume that they're very popular and I'm not.
Right.
So that's envy. And that you bring that to the Facebook. Facebook doesn't create it.
It's the same thing when people talked about having happy families being seen on TV and the Christmas specials and they're all happy. And why aren't I that happy? Well, it's because it's all fake. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all done by directors and writers and people in show business.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about different generations. A 2010 AARP survey found that 35% of adults older than 45 were chronically lonely, as opposed to 20% of a similar group a decade earlier.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And it raises the question, Facebook and the other social media, Twitter, I guess, has really taken off in the past 10 years. But so has loneliness.
Right.
So you raise the question, well, did Facebook or Twitter cause loneliness?
Mm-hmm. Or are lonely people attracted to it?
Exactly. What comes first?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's basically an unanswered question. But I think the important thing is what we were talking about earlier. People are who they are. And if somebody is lonely to begin with or down on themselves to begin with, Facebook isn't going to change that.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they use the Facebook as a tool to enhance their face-to-face connection with others. And they can do that, establish relationships with long-ago lost friends. That is enhancing connection.
Yeah.
And at my age, I'm finding that very valuable as I get back in touch with some high school and college people.
But then when you get back in touch, is it just Facebook or are you picking up the phone and make – that's what I'm saying. So there is that personal connection. It's not
just
Facebook.
Well, there's both. There's both. Yes, the obviously the meaningful one is really face-to-face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Again, that comes in the category of what I said before when Mark also talked about get moving.
Mm-hmm.
So get moving doesn't necessarily mean get your large motor muscles moving. It also means do something.
Sure.
Keep moving forward. So if you can connect with someone through Facebook, that could lead to the next logical point of maybe picking up the telephone, maybe meeting with them if they're close by, maybe, oh gosh, sending them a real letter, something like that. You know, so one thing can lead to the other. One step can lead in front of the next step, but you have to take that first step, and as you do that, you will find other steps present themselves.
Yeah, there's some interesting research also that people who use Facebook and get comments, written comments on their wall, they tend to feel a little bit less lonely and more connected than people who just click on the like business, because that's lazy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you get down to the details, minute details of how you use Facebook, there's even associations with loneliness or not.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then we have this being alone together. We especially see this in some of the younger generation.
Yeah.
You know, they're all on their phones or their iPads.
Right.
I mean, they're in a group, but they're not talking.
Yeah, technology does foster, one writer said, three gratifying fantasies that the use of technology enhances, or illusions. One is that we have control of where we put our attention. So that if kids are sitting around in a group and everybody's on their cell phone texting others, they have control of attending to the outside, which is what they want at that moment, as opposed to attending to each other, which can be messy and more stressful. So that's one fantasy, that we can put our attention where we want it. Number two is that we're always will be heard. So the thought of, you know, if you post something out there, you're always going to be acknowledged and listened to. And number three, that you never really have to be alone. So that if you're standing in a supermarket checkout line and you don't know anybody, you can connect to others right at that moment. So there's where technology fosters some really illusions, because these are not really connected experiences that address true loneliness, but they assuage us momentarily.
You know, this article, this is that Sherry Turkle article that mentioned this. And just following that, those three comments, she writes, because the moment that people are alone, even for a few seconds, they become anxious, they panic, they fidget, they reach for a device. Just think of people at the checkout line or at a red light. Being alone feels like a problem that needs to be solved. And so we try to solve it by connecting. But here, connection is more like a symptom than a cure. It expresses, but it doesn't solve an underlying problem.
Well, that's a good point. You know, before we had the technology, you would find that people who felt very lonely would often just go around where there are other people. So you see people window shopping at supermarkets just to be around other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't have any interaction. They wouldn't try to talk with them. But simply being around other human beings feeds an energy.
Mm-hmm.
And creates a positive vibe in someone. So they're not alone, even though if they don't know the people that they're walking around the supermarket with. And you see that certainly in big cities where a sense of isolation has always existed. And you see the same thing in that example you mentioned, a bunch of teenagers or younger adults sitting in a group but being on their phones. They're getting the vibe from being around other human beings. It gives them a little bit more energy to do something. And the something they choose to do is, I think, probably the path of least resistance in some respects, which is being on the cell phone. But again, it bespeaks to the internal psychological processes we have that just manifested differently. You know, Woody Allen had the movie out, I think, Sleeper. We talked about being 50 or 100 years in the future. The same kind of existential loneliness that was in a lot of his earlier films just manifests itself a different mm-hmm. manner, but still had the same thing. So we're dealing with universal constructs here that
sure.
continue on.
On the Cape, I've wondered if the post office kind of serves as a social
or the dump.
Or the dump, yes.
The other thing I thought, Sherry Turkle had an interesting comment in her Connected But Alone. She says, an 18-year-old boy who uses texting for almost everything says to me wistfully, someday, but certainly not now, I'd like to learn how to have a conversation.
Right.
And, you know, I think it's for some, and this isn't true for all kids, but, you know, it is, they don't look you in the eye. You know, if you interview kids, you see a lot of them have a tough time with that face-to-face conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, they have more control if they have, they can use their thumbs to print out the words.
Well, I would think that's more of an avoidance capacity. I wouldn't think of it as a strength, no. Trying to have their control, but a symptom. I think they're probably training themselves, and we can train ourselves a lot of different ways. I think they're training themselves to be socially isolated. So if this boy says, I wish I could have a conversation, well, it pretty much starts with just that sentence that he said and having another human respond to you, and poof, sure. All of a sudden, instant conversation.
Right.
Maybe a short one, but a conversation nonetheless.
So there's a genetic component to all of this.
Yeah, that's interesting. There is a genetic component, and it's been estimated by the twin studies, basically, is the way it's been defined or demonstrated, that maybe about 50% of people, the 50% of the vulnerability or the sensitivity to being lonely is inherited. It runs in families. And I could accept that. And it makes sense that it should be that way. So, yes, there is a component.
Yeah, I would have to respectfully dissent from that.
I think
all the studies that I've read about heritability factors and the meta-studies that sort of grouped all these individual studies together, the heritability factor is remarkably constant and very low overall for most things. But even if it was as high as 50 or 60, heck, even if we inherited 100% of the tendencies, we have to talk, and Mark and I have talked about this before, about genetic expression.
That's right.
How are these genetic tendencies expressed?
Right.
And are you going to let yourself sink down to the lowest common denominator? You know, are you not going to, for example, stepping out of our theme just for a second, are you not going to be more successful than your parents were? Are you going to keep yourself less successful out of some kind of psychological respect, you know, for your parents? Or are you going to self-actualize and try and just be the best that you can, irrespective of what reason, you know, whether it's genetics or whether it's a reinforcement or whether it's a troubled childhood or whatever? How are you going to express that genetic inheritance,
right.
which I think is
absolutely.
More important?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you get down into in the dirt of this question, really into the details of it, there's been research, gets back, we've talked about before, Harlow's monkeys, where monkeys are raised either with the regular mother or with a wire mother where there's not any warmth or interaction. Well, taking it further down into our era now, it turns out that some genes have been identified that get turned on or turned off differentially according to what the mothering experience is. These genes have a lot to do with immunity. They've been demonstrated genes having to do with the strength of the immune system get either turned on or turned off depending on the condition of the early mothering.
Mm-hmm.
And more important, and even, well, equally as important, if a monkey was raised by a wire monkey, therefore had most likely a damaged or a less efficient immune system, for instance, if they're fostered later on by a real monkey, those genes that get turned off could get turned
on again.
Right.
Yeah.
So the chemical evidence for environment and experience is there on a molecular level, down to the genes being turned on and turned off. So when we say hereditary, we're talking about a mix of both what is in the genes and then what the environment does to turn on or turn off the genes. That's called the epigenetic expression.
Right. And this is what quite often I mentioned in my sessions with patients is that there are numerous times throughout your lifespan that you can go back and rectify some things that that perhaps weren't so great for you. And there were many writers over the years who have talked about it's never too late to have a happy childhood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go back and be reparented. Many people can go back and reparent themselves if that's the thematic impact that you want to have. But as Mark says, we can turn these things on and off. We
right.
can turn these genes on and off, and it really is within our ability to do that.
Right.
And I think that really should probably be a takeaway lesson, that we have some control over our capacity for being lonely and being happy, and we should try to actively choose how to be happier.
You know, it reminds me of when I first started out on this field, when only primary theory was psychoanalytic. And many of us will remember the book and the movie I Never Promised You a Rose Garden was based on the work that a New York psychiatrist did, Frieda Fromm Rockman, in which she basically cured a rather disturbed schizophrenic girl. And the belief that Frieda Fromm Rockman had was that there was no mental illness that trust and intimacy could not fix, could not cure. So we're kind of back there. You know, we've come full circle. Now we know the biology of that, and we know a little bit better techniques to get there, a little bit more efficient techniques to get there than the traditional analytic, psychoanalytic ones. But we're basically have come back there.
Yeah. We're talking about the psychology of loneliness. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the psychology of loneliness with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abbruzzese. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So, Dr. Abbruzzese, you were talking earlier about sort of changing the way you think about things. And in some of the information that Dr. Whaley sent before the show, there's this practical suggestions, if you will, of dealing with it. And this one speaks to what you were saying. It says, take an objective look at your thinking. True facts, lonely people tend to interpret situations more negatively. When Bill, your coworker, gives you the cold shoulder one morning, you tend to think he's mad at you. Turns out Sally saw the same behavior toward her and just assumed Bill was having a bad day, which he was. The reality you live is the one you make in your head.
Well, that's true. Also, people who are depressed. We have old research indicating that people who are depressed also negatively evaluate people's behavior towards them. And there is some research out there that indicates that people who are depressed create their own depth of depression because they make themselves feel worse. So how you think really is everything. How you think is everything. It's never too late to try and change the way you think. Even if it only makes you feel a bit brighter just for a couple of seconds, you can always think again. We talk about people who are caregivers. You really have to keep your energy up as a caregiver. And there are certain tricks of the trade, certain techniques you can use to keep yourself full of energy and enthusiasm. But understand that everyone gets worn down after a while. Mm-hmm. And all of these psychological conditions, we're talking about anxiety, depression, stress, they're fairly common. And we have to be able to take care of our own psychological health the way we have to take care of our physical health. You know, if you don't walk, if you don't exercise, then you know you're going to put yourself at risk for a lot of physical ailments, certainly when it comes to aging. If you're a runner and you run the wrong way, you can get shin splints, you can damage yourself. And these are just common sense things that people who practice these behaviors can learn to use as coping skills, and they can learn to take care of themselves. So we talked before about how the Dalai Lama still meditates every day. And I said, well, why does he have to do it? He's been doing it for about 67 years. You think he would have learned by now? Well, there are some things you simply have to do on a regular basis. You need to drink water on a regular basis. You need to eat on a regular basis. No one seems to doubt that. But you also have to monitor your thinking on a regular basis. You have to rest yourself on a regular basis. You have to recharge your batteries on a regular basis. And it changes from person to person how they can recharge those batteries. But what we all have to remember is that it's important to keep our batteries recharged. We need to take time for ourselves whenever ourselves tell us it's time, whether we need to retreat, whether we need to meditate, we need to rest more or nap more or introspect more or practice mindfulness. Whatever is going to work for our own organism is what we need to do. We need to do it on a regular basis. And people tend to eschew that because there's no time. Now, how do you take a half hour a day to meditate? Who's going to find a half hour a day when you're commuting an hour each way, you know, to work sometimes? But we have to find a way to take care of ourselves, and that goes back to what Mark talks about from mindfulness and being self-aware. Self-awareness really sets the stage for physical and psychological and emotional health.
Yeah, and just as a corollary to that, when you do have a negative experience, like loneliness as a stressful experience, you want to realize that it's just a feeling. It's not the reality. It's not the world. It's not the whole story. Mm-hmm. It's a feeling state that you have at that moment, probably for some reasons. Mm-hmm. And it it too will pass, even if you do nothing. But it is a feeling, and it doesn't have to swallow you up and be your whole reality at that time. Doing all the things that you just mentioned, the mindfulness, the looking at your thinking, changing your thinking, are all the practical tools. But you want to first realize feelings are just that. They're feelings.
They're transitory. They come and they go. That's why the authors, the great writers talk about the waves of emotion.
Right.
You're standing on the beach. Where do the waves go? Well, they wash up on the shore. Where do they go after that?
Back out.
They go back out. You know, even a tsunami, we have experience with tsunami. Well, where do the waves go? Eventually, they go back out.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do. So the waves of emotion wash over us.
That's right.
And the analogy I use sometimes, you're standing on the ocean, the wave is coming in, and it's lapping at your knees or your waist, and that's too much. You take a couple of steps back.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. And then it only goes down to your ankles or your feet, or you want to go in further, then you can do that. We have control. We have self-regulatory control, but it all begins with awareness. And it really is not much more complicated than that. I know people sometimes prefer to have something very demanding that they have to do.
Right.
You will feel better only if you climb this mountain. You will feel better only if you do this, do that, complicated thing. But when it comes to psychological well-being, sometimes all you have to do are very, very simple steps. They're so simple they seem deceptive, and most people dismiss them.
Right.
But that is the trickery that's involved. Don't dismiss these simple steps.
Exactly. Well, amen.
When you're talking about the awareness, you can see it's just like that. When you have something stressful happening, if you're not listening to yourself, you know what's happening, but you're too busy to deal with it. You just push it down.
Point.
You push those feelings down.
Really
and
good
because
point.
You've got to keep going.
Again, what the great writers have talked about, that still small voice inside, what some people call a conscious. You know, your conscience is telling, maybe not a good idea. And sometimes we override that. Oh, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
What's the worst that could happen?
Sure.
Oh, let me give it. You know, you really do have to pay attention. I think sometimes in our modern society, in most modern societies when they come and go, I think we train ourselves to ignore our better judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark is talking about training ourselves to pay attention to our better judgment. Because if someone comes up to you and says, you know, I have an idea, why don't we try that? It's easy for a boss to say, oh, that's a silly idea. We're not going to do that.
Right.
Okay, I guess we're not going to do that. But it could have been a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
But because you have someone who's so conditioned to saying no and not paying attention, that they train themselves to not pay attention to their own good ideas.
And of course, if you don't pay attention for things for a while, they become bigger problems.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And those, like you mentioned. Now, when we were talking about loneliness being a stressor and part of stress, what about depression? How does depression connect to loneliness?
Well, that's a good question. Did depression come first and then loneliness, or did loneliness come? That's
all these unanswered questions.
Yeah, all these psychological conditions, they have reciprocal interactions. I'd like to say this came first and that came first, but I think it's much more important. It may be intellectually interesting to people like Mark and me to figure out how this happened, but practically, it doesn't matter where you fell. It matters how you get up.
Yeah, right.
So focus on, this is not where I want to be. Okay, good. Next question, how did I get here? No. The next question is, where do you want to be? Instead, how are you going to get there?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Instead
right.
of thinking, gee, how do they get? And I think, and I don't mean this to be a terrible criticism to a lot of my colleagues, but sometimes in therapy, education programs train people to just rehash how someone got to where they are.
Right.
And the point is, how do you get out of there and get to where you want to be? That's what therapy is all about.
That's right.
Yeah.
So
how do you get out?
Yeah, because when you're down, you can't use the how did you get there very effectively. It's not productive terribly.
Right.
It's good to know and good to learn from down the line.
But you don't want to repeat it.
Right.
And the time to introspect is when you're a little bit further away, you have some perspective.
Exactly.
Because you're in the middle of the forest. You take a look at all the trees around you. That's not the best time to sort of do a lot of introspection. Get out of there. Keep moving.
That's right.
All right. So I can imagine there might be some people listening who do feel lonely and, you know, for whatever situation, like you used somebody earlier, you said, you know, somebody elderly, maybe their spouse has died. Some of their friends have they don't have the same. And they're probably thinking, well, what do I do? I know I'm lonely. I feel sad. What's the step? Where should they go? If you've been doing this for a long time, it might be really hard. Like we're saying, well, change your thought process, but that's hard for people to do.
True. And exercise is a concentration exercise. Very simple. These exercises of mindfulness are very simple. Just take a look out the window or stare at a wall. And as you're looking, as the thoughts come into your head, irrespective of what they are, just sort of observe them this is easier for adults to do than for little children to do. Simply observe them and maybe label them and let them go. So, oh, I'm feeling sad right now. Oh, I'm thinking about when my spouse passed away. And then let it go. And as you do that, the thoughts will come in. You're going to not evaluate them. You're just going to label what you're seeing and then let them go. And that is the first step. Some people find this enormously difficult the first time they do it. But the second and third time they do it, they find it so much easier. They can't believe how easy it was, and they marvel at how difficult it was the very first time. But this is a very, very quick learning curve.
Sure.
Doing something as simple as that is a technique I often give to people. And you can find a lot of these similar recommendations if you just go to the internet, speaking of technology, and Google mindfulness and see what John Kabat-Zinn has come up with.
Yep.
That I think he's at Harvard, and some other people have come up with things, and just get ideas from them. And they will show you on YouTube, they will show you an entire hour's worth of a program. How you do mindfulness.
I think the one key ingredient in what you're saying is to resist the natural impulse or natural compulsion to judge yourself according to how the thoughts, what the thoughts are, and to say you're not doing it right or any kind of judgment. You want to achieve that mindfulness exercise that's productive, you want to hold off on judgment and look at judgment as a thought that's coming on and examine that.
Right, just another thought.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Right.
So what about children? You say you could deal with differently with children. How do you get a lonely child?
It's roughly the same kind of technique, but you have to coach the children through it. You need to coach them more, because when you say something like, don't evaluate what you're thinking, don't make a judgment of what you're seeing, quite often the kids will look at you and say, what
are
does
you
that
talking
mean?
About? Yeah,
right? So you have to use different language, and you have to sort of coach them through it. And you start out in maybe 10-second segments, then a 20-second segment, then 30-second segment. And you also can combine – some kids have a predilection for physical activity. So sometimes you want to combine it with a physical activity that is distracting to them. Basically, when thoughts come into our mind, we're distracted by our negative thoughts. You know, we're never distracted by our positive thoughts because we'd never pay any attention to those. Those suckers come in. We just, you know, they just go with no problem. But a negative thought, for some reason, we think, oh, I have to pay attention to this. Well, it's not necessarily the case. You want to monitor it and want to take a look at what it is, but you don't want to give it undue credence. You don't want to give it too much of an emotional valence. And our negative thoughts distract us. So with kids, with people who are primarily physical in nature, they distract themselves from their negative thinking by distracting themselves with physical behavior. And they distract themselves in a more positive kind of way. And sometimes I have kids do jumping jacks, or I have them do one or two push-ups, or I have them try and balance on one leg. And that distracts them from their negative thinking, because it's too difficult for them to balance themselves and they have to focus everything on that.
It gets back to the get busy.
That's right.
Yeah, get busy,
get involved, get engaged,
right.
As opposed to sitting and ruminating.
Yeah. Right. We're talking about a multimodal approach. Get everything involved. Don't just do one thing. Whatever multimodal between your physicality, your thinking, your emotions, whichever you can engage these things in, engage as many of them as you can. Well, if you're bedridden because you have the flu, you know, don't get up and run up and down the stairs. But you can do something. You can raise your arms. You know,
you can call somebody.
You can call somebody. Yeah. That's right.
Well, it's funny you said this is my grandmother used to always say she was too busy to get sick, but she lived many many years alone, was never lonely, but she was very busy. She volunteered at different organizations, was involved in all of her grandchildren's lives. You know,
well, again, she was too busy. Yeah. Getting busy is really important. So getting busy does not necessarily involve a lot of other people. You can get busy with the garden. You can get busy with communing with nature. You can get busy with thinking and planning of what you're going to do when spring gets here. So you can be busy with a lot of productive plans for the future and having hope for the future. I read an article about Jacques Cousteau, who was talking when he was 82 or 83 years old. He was working on his next five-year plan about how he's going to develop something underseas. Mm-hmm. He's 82 years old. He's got something planned 5 years in the future. So that's what you need to do. It could be something as simple as that.
Right. Sure.
Psychologist Michael Abbruzzese, psychiatrist Mark Whaley. As always, thank you both.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.